be healthy, and it's the most welcome sight in the world. It's her, and she's well. Gently, the smoke lowers her to the ground, curves in on itself, and vanishes. My mother looks down at her legs, then at her arms. She even runs a hand across her taut belly underneath her shirt, astonished at the reboot of her body. She's a fairy tale character who's been visited by the Good Witch, by a benevolent godmother, and she's both bewildered and delighted with the transformation. "You're back!" I say, and I run to her. Her solid arms wrap around me, holding me tight. This is the mom I missed. The brave one. The strong one. I pull back to regard her once more, my hands in her hands. "You're beautiful," I say. And that's how I know my father is really and truly dead, and he's not coming back. His work has been undone. "Thank you," she says to me, "though I didn't do this. But maybe, when I touched the snow gator's head, I activated something, set in motion the animal's instinct. Or maybe the lady sent him on this mission to right a wrong, to restore some small semblance of justice in the Calandros family. No wonder she wanted to win the snow gator so badly. He's quite a prize." My mother looks at the door. "Go," I say, encouraging her. She walks to the door, no longer taking tentative shuffling steps, but instead walking on strong, sturdy legs. I hold the door open for her, and bask in the sight of my mother, walking outside for the first time in years, the sun beating down on her skin. She looks up at the sky, letting the rays coat her face. Then she turns to me, a smile so big and radiant it could warm me for the rest of my days. A tear of happiness slides down her cheek. It is glorious. Then I wait. I wait for the leagues to come for me. I wait for them to wrap metal around my wrists and make a show of me, like they did with Reginald. I'd be a prize to trot before the cameras. A real warning. A top ME Leagues performer caught not only using a granter, but also apprehended for having stolen the elements. I'd be the perfect elemental artist to make an example of, a warning sign for generations of youth to come. Here's what happens when you steal. Here's what happens when you wish. A future vanished, a lifetime ban from performing. A forever ban for the family. They have to be coming for me like they did for Reginald. Imran knows what I wished for, so he has to know my stage name wasn't a lie after all. It was the truth, under his nose from the very start. But Imran doesn't show. No one shows, except the Division of Wildlife officer the next morning. My mother called the department to officially report my father's death. She is suddenly businesslike and competent as she handles what needs to be done. Jana and I sit on the couch in the living room while my mother talks to him. "Then an alligator just broke into the house and ate my husband," she says, reporting the facts, managing to push out a few tears. I think they might be real. I think a part of her is sad. But a bigger part, a more important part, is moving on.
"You saw it happen?"
one of the officers says to me. He has a mustache and holds a small spiral notebook.
"Any distinguishing characteristics on this animal?"
"He's ice cold. He acts like a dog. He protected my sister and me. He lives deep in the Everglades with the wisest woman I've ever known. Some might call her a guardian angel." "He was green," I say. I assume a sad look, like I miss what the snow gator ate. I glance at Jana, my eyes telling her to be quiet. She reads me instantly, understanding the direction. She knows the gator saved me, and saved her, so she doesn't say a word. The wildlife officer scribbles something in his notebook,
then tells my mother he'll be in touch. She walks him to the door, even escorts him out to his vehicle, just because she can. She comes back in the house. "I don't think we'll be seeing him again," she says, and there's a wink in her voice. She claps her hands together once, looks from me to Jana. "Now, shall we start packing up the house?"
"Why?"
"I thought we might want to get out of Florida."
"But Mom, I have friends here,"
Jana protests, and they continue like that for the next hour, pushing and pulling, resisting and insisting. And there's something strangely comforting to witnessing the exchange. It's the closest thing to normal I've ever seen in my family. That night, I take my sister pool hopping. The Markins are back in town, but another family next door to them is gone for a few days, so we sneak into their screened-in pool. Jana dives in quietly this time, but when she surfaces, she has that same bright smile she had the last time we swam together. "This is how I like to swim," she says when she reaches me. "This is how you should swim," I say, pushing wet strands of hair off my face.
"Race?"
She nods, gives me my head start, and I shoot off underwater. As usual, she beats me. As usual, I don't mind one bit.
"Don't go,"
she says as we tread water in the deep end. You have no idea how much I wish I could stay. Elise bursts through my door and grabs me. I smile and she beams, but we are both sharing smiles of regret. I told her everything on the phone last night. "I guess my weekend leave was too late," she says, "for everything." "It's okay. I was always a ticking time bomb."
"This is all my fault."
I shake my head. "It's not your fault."
"I should have swum to shore. I should never have joined the lookouts. I should have chained myself to your side."
"Stop," I say, and walk into my front yard with her. We sit on the sidewalk, under a small patch of shade from an overgrown palm tree. "You saved my life for many years. Now, I have to pay up."
"I would have done this forever."
"It's fine. I mean, it sucks, but it's fine. At least Jana is safe, and my mom is back."
"So you have to be the sacrificial whatever?"
I shrug. I've had the last few years to get ready for this in some ways. I always knew I was living on borrowed time. I always knew I was dying.
"It's just the way these deals work."
"The deal sucks." "Yeah, some deals do suck. I'll give you that." She leans her head on my shoulder, and I pet her hair. This may be the first time I've comforted her. Time marches forward quickly, and when the seventh day arrives, the house is packed, the for sale sign is posted in the front yard, and Jana has barely accepted this newfound authority figure in her life. Jana's only known our mom as helpless. My mother has never set the rules, never made the decisions for my sister. Now she's doing just that.
"It's time for a change, Jana," my mother says.
Jana slams her door, and I'm about to go talk to her, to try to help her understand. But then, three figures appear in a whoosh in my driveway, like they sailed through the sky and are floating down on invisible umbrellas. One of them is Taj, and my heart leaps from my chest. I want to run to him, to touch him, to talk to him, to spend the night on a rooftop. He's back. But he doesn't look at me. He's aloof, and his eyes are trained far away from me, fixed on some unseen point behind my head. I swallow, and my throat is dry. Why is he looking away from me? Why isn't he happy to see me too? Even if it's only for the exchange. My heart beats too fast, like a hummingbird, and I wish it would settle down. The man and the woman with him walk toward my door. I try to will him to meet my eyes, to look up, to notice me, to connect with me as he always did. But he stares past me. Only the man and woman look at me. The man wears a well-fitted suit, dove gray with slim pink pinstripes and aviator sunglasses. The woman is dressed in a silk blouse, pencil skirt, and sleek black heels. She has long blonde hair with a luxuriant wave to it. Are they coming to take me away, or to give me a makeover? Sorella, the woman says, then flashes a badge inside a wallet, as a cop would do. She uses only her first name, and the badge is gold. Real gold hard metal. It says, the Union of Granters. From the Union, Compliance Bureau. She tips her forehead to the gentleman. This is Barry.
Barry? A woman named Sorella works with a man named Barry?
I open the door and step outside. I cross my arms and glance at Taj, trying to connect silently with him. But the spot behind my head is endlessly fascinating to him, and it aches inside my chest, the way he won't acknowledge me. Then he meets my eyes, and his are cold and conniving. Like a blinding light, I get it. I step back, hold on to the doorway, because it feels like I might fall. I'm so stupid, so foolish. I never saw it coming. He was using me all along to engineer his own freedom from the start. This is the real Taj now. This is the Taj I met the first night. The trickster toying Taj. The cool Taj who didn't care for his fate. All the other nights, he was acting. It's like I've been punched in the gut, and I want to double over in pain, to press my teeth into my lips because this hurts so much, knowing he played me the whole time. And I fell for his routine. Right from the start, when he asked me to wait to wish. He set me up, took me on dates, stretched out the whole ruse, told me grantor secrets, provisos, stories about falling in love, stories about payment, about offering oneself for payment, so I could fall for him, so he could be free. He held me off from wishing all the time so he could buy time. I bought it all. Hook, line, and sinker. I believed it all, from the green light at the end of the dock, to the stars above the rooftop, to the hope that stories well told could free you from your fate. Like a seduction, I was the one seduced. Oh, but he was right. He wove fables full of kisses, full of sad eyes, full of dreams for a wisher who'd fall in love with him and free him. He got what he wanted. Freedom granted from a fool. Some story you told, I say sharply to him, because I never stray far from my store of anger. He says nothing. His face isn't even stony, just indifferent toward me. You could make your story 1,002, don't you think? I say, spitting words out at him. The Grantor and the girl Prometheus. Make an addendum to Arabian Nights because you're just as good. He rolls his eyes, shrugs his shoulders, and holds out his hands.
Don't tell me you're surprised.
Yeah, I actually am.
Well, that's kind of a bummer for you.
No kidding. And to think I believed you, I say, and my throat hitches, but I won't give in to tears for him.
I believed it all.
That was the error of your ways, Arya, he says in an admonishing tone.
Because we may be mastered granters, but the real master we serve is the wish to be free. Every day, all the time. Sometimes you do whatever it takes to be free. But you know that, right?
He's kicking me while I'm down. He's smashing fists and feet and elbows into all the soft parts of me, all the parts that let him in. I should have trusted my instincts all along, the ones that have told me to never trust. Can we please get on with this?
Sorella says in an exasperated voice. Barry flicks a long sheet of paper from his hands, unrolling it, a bailiff before the court about to read off the charges. He lowers his aviator shades.
According to wish 5,678,972, made on the evening of August 2nd, exactly 7 days ago, you, Aria Kalandros, have agreed to exchange yourself for the grantor you received said wish from.
Barry looks at me over his glasses.
That would be grantor 542. Taj Rahim. It is now.
Barry lifts his elbow in a sharp, robotic gesture.
Time to collect upon your payment.
Sorella chimes in.
We will take you to your jurisdiction in Manhattan, effectively replacing Taj Rahim from this day forward, and placing you in full responsibility for responding to, interacting with, and bargaining on behalf of all grantors with any wishers experiencing a need powerful enough to find you on the island of Manhattan. This is your sole jurisdiction, and no other grantor shall infringe upon it, and you shall not infringe upon the jurisdiction of any other grantor. You will uphold all the rules, regulations, quid pro quos, provisos, and quibbles, recording all wishes in strictest accordance with the union of grantors forevermore, and into perpetuity throughout your servitude. So help you God. Sorella's face is stony as she reads, but when she reaches the last words, so help you God, she chuckles.
Assuming there even is a God, she whispers, like we're in on this together, as if we're co-conspirators. That makes Barry laugh.
Higher authority, he says with a snort. As if.
Taj joins in, and the three of them are cracking themselves up with their insider grantor jokes. I'm one of them now, or about to be, but the joke is on me. Soon, the three of them settle down.
One more item, Sorella adds. You will be allowed one phone call per month during the times when you're in existence. But otherwise, grantors are forbidden from seeing their family members. We will escort you to your quarters so that you may begin your new position as grantor 892, she tells me. You will no longer use your last name.
I'm just going to say goodbye to my mom and my sister, I say. And I try to push Taj and the way he deceived me out of my mind, even though it's my whole and healed heart that hurts more than it ever did. I knew we weren't going to have a happily ever after today, but I thought we'd have a bittersweet goodbye, a moment when he confessed he loved me too. Instead, I am the butt of the joke. I turn to the two people I can truly trust, my mom and my sister. We've been saying goodbye all week, but even so, those preparatory farewells could not have readied me for the real one. I find my sister in the kitchen. A tear is sliding down her face. I wrap my arms around her, hold her tight.
Who's going to go pool hopping with me?
There's a hitch in her throat.
First of all, I hear it's cold in Jersey, so good luck with that.
Second, Mom will. She'll swim with you and make it fun again.
Like you did for me, Jana says.
Yeah. Then I pull back, grip her by the shoulders, look her in the eyes. You need to listen to Mom, okay? Give her a chance to be Mom again. Do that for me.
I will.
And whatever you do, have fun. You can do anything. Paint houses, make clocks, travel the world, weave water or don't weave water. Do whatever you want, Jana. Promise me? I hold her face in my hands and wipe away one of her tears.
I promise.
Then I turn to my mom.
Take care of Jana. Don't ever stop. Don't ever go back to how it was, to how you were.
Never, my mom says. The mom of old, the mom of new. The three of us hug, and I don't know if I'll ever see them again. If we'll ever have anything more than the phone calls, like Taj had with his mom. I return to the door where Barry, Sorella, and Taj are chatting. Taj looks animated, as if he's just been telling them a story, and they both smile and laugh before they look at me. Everything is business as usual for Taj. I want to hate him, but maybe I'd have done the same. I looked out for me before I looked out for him. So, who am I to judge him? Sorella speaks again. And now we make the exchange. Sorella and Barry each take hold of one of Taj's wrists, press hard, then let go. I expect him to disappear, to flit away, to flap his arms and be able to fly off into the sky. But he's now been stripped of all powers. He has no more magic. He's human. And when Barry and Sorella take my hands, I feel a surge of warmth and of power erupt in my body, as if my veins are flushed of blood and replaced with something else. Something liquid that becomes sweet smoke to bestow the greatest gifts at the greatest price.
And now, Grantor 542 has been officially relieved of all Grantor duties from this moment forward. And Grantor 892 has taken his place, Barry says, then writes down the time, date, and location that I've taken over.
We're gone, traveling at the speed of light through time and space and nothingness. When my feet touch ground again, we've arrived at the sidewalk grade outside the Chrysler building. Barry lifts it up, and the pair of them walks me through the tunnels. Tunnels I can now see clearly. I can now navigate through, as if I'm wearing infrared goggles, to the library that used to belong to the boy I fell in love with. The boy who used me to get out of this prison. Chapter 31. Reflected Back. I stumble into the library, and I try to lunge for the Registry of Wishes, still wide open on Taj's desk. My desk now. But my breath is racing, and I'm sucking in air through the slimmest of straws, and my neck is squeezed by a thousand mighty hands. The light goes out, and the walls close in. The ceiling compresses down on me as if I'm buried alive. I'm choking as I'm crushed, and then, just like that, it's over. An alarm goes off. I can't hear it, but I can feel it all over me. My body has become a rooster, the crow that starts the day. My skin, my senses, my eyes and breath and brain are rattled awake. Not gently like a nap, but crudely, the morning after a very late night, when all you want to do is slam the snooze button and sleep more. My legs are heavy concrete blocks weighing me down. My arms are logs. But the alarm is stronger, and I'm pulled awake, yanked from this hibernation into a loud pop, like bubble wrap stepped on by someone wearing heavy shoes. I look down, and the pop is me. The snapping sound of my body being reshaped from nothingness into somethingness. I hold my hands in front of me. They're hands, my hands. Then legs and arms and belly and face. And I'm all here. After months, weeks, days, or could it be hours of not being here? I don't know. But I lift my feet, wiggle them one by one, getting used to being corporeal again after being evanescent. Then I notice how I'm dressed. I'm in tailored slacks and a white button-down blouse and a pair of patent leather black flats. I must look hideous. I'd never dress like this. Where are my clothes? My combat boots, my jeans, my short skirts and black cotton tees. I hunt around the library, but they're not here. Nothing's here but shelves and shelves of books, extending as far back as I can see.
just like when Taj resided here. Taj. His name is a pang in the chest, as the full memory of the last time I saw him collides into me. He made a mockery of me. I was played like a fool. Such easy bait. And I hurt so much, too. Every organ inside me aches because I miss him. I hate that I miss him. But I fell for him for a reason. He was so kind, and he was so handsome, and he understood me in a way no one ever had. How could I not fall for him? But I was selfish, too, just like him. So what right do I have to be mad at him for tricking me to free him? We both played the other. We were both in it for our own needs. As I search for another outfit, I can't focus on him or myself or the pangs inside me, because I find myself drawn to the door, and I'm no longer in the library. I'm walking through the tunnels, and it's not absolute blackness anymore. It's bright light, beckoning and clear, and it guides me to the underside of a grate. That's when I realize why I'm awake, why I'm alive again, what the alarm bell sounding inside me was. I've been found. We are found in the wanting. I've been summoned on my first official call as a grantor. And I don't even know what day it is, what time it is, what year it is. But I know this. I'm no longer nuclear. I'm not running at Aria temperature. My blood feels light, my veins flooded with a wispy, smoky grantor magic that's so different from the fire I'm used to living with. I push up on the grate and climb out. It's midday, late afternoon by the sun's position in the sky. It's warm, but no longer hot. I see a group of school kids across the street, backpacks slung over shoulders. I see a newsstand and take a quick look at the date on the paper. It's September. 2 weeks have passed. No one notices me. A pristinely dressed 17-year-old in New York City. But this is how grantors dress. I begin walking south on the avenue, and I bump into a girl a year or so younger than I am. She has a plain face and mousy hair pulled back in a low ponytail. She's got on jeans tucked into lace-up, scuffed-up boots. I feel a stab of jealousy that's quickly displaced by a reminder, as if someone is talking quietly in my ear, that I don't get to have feelings or emotions, because I exist to serve, and I've found my wisher. "Hey, what are you up to?" I ask. The girl shifts her eyes side to side. "Looking for someone?" "I suspect you're looking for me."
"Why would you say that?"
She sounds suspicious.
"Call it a crazy hunch, or call it my own experience," I say, and though the words roll off my tongue easily, they taste so bitter.
"But who are you?" That's the question, isn't it?
"I'm the person you think can solve all your problems. Rub my lamp, and I'll give you whatever you want, and life will be good again," I say, somehow sliding right into my first day on the job. I feel slippery and smarmy, the snake oil man in the bazaar. I've become sarcastic, too, and I don't like it. The old Aria tugs at my mind, but the grantor inside me is in charge now.
"How do I know you're a grantor?"
"Ah, the proof test. You want proof. It's so cute." "I once wanted proof, too," I say. And it's as if I've been plunged back in time, only I'm on the other side now, and I've become the Taj from the first night. Correction. There was only one Taj, the Taj from all the nights, the facade of Taj. But his bluffs worked on me, so I borrow from his playbook. I disappear and reappear on the other side of the avenue. The girl crosses over.
"You really are a grantor," she says, kind of awestruck. She reminds me of the occasional fans I'd encounter after Wonder shows. That time seems so long ago.
I'd only made one big mistake then. I had so many more to make. I curtsy a thanks, and I find myself wondering where that came from. I'm not a curtsier. I'm not a pencil skirt wearer. I'm not super outgoing friendly. I'm mad as hell that I'm stuck. But yet I have to curtsy. The curse of the mastered granter. This girl is my master now. My stomach growls and grumbles. I haven't eaten in ages, but it's not up to me to eat. It's up to this girl, and I'll have to convince her to grab a bite. What's your name?
Blake Vader.
Are you hungry, Blake? She shakes her head.
No, I just ate.
So you don't want to get something to eat? She shakes her head again.
No, not really.
Because I could really go for a sandwich, I say, and I hope Blake is nice enough to suggest getting at least a snack from the corner deli, but she seems preoccupied. I would love it if we could chat at a deli, please. Maybe you can eat later, because I need something so badly, she says as we stand on the street corner and afternoon traffic rushes by in a flurry of exhaust and honked horns. Okay, what do you need? I ask. And part of me is coldly impressed that Blake is all business in a way I never was. She's ready to dive in, and getting to know her granter doesn't even cross her mind. I'm not a person. I'm a shortcut to her problem.
There's a boy I love, and he doesn't even know I'm alive.
Blake, sorry to break it to you, but I should let you know that there are three preliminary conditions and exceptions to wishing. I can't make someone fall in love with you. I can't bring someone back from the dead. And I can't grant you more wishes. So as you can see, we'll have to call it a day, I say. Then decide to add a warning all on my own. Besides, the best way to get someone to fall in love with you is to trick them into it. She gives me a curious look as she tucks a loose strand of stringy hair behind her ear. I didn't say I wanted you to make him fall in love with me. What do you want me to do then?
I want you to make me beautiful, so he'll notice me.
She's so dreamy and hopeful, like this is a movie, like she can just rub a lamp, and a happy, cheery genie will appear to deliver pizza, and earth, wind, air, or fire. Really?
Yes, really.
I sigh. I want to tell her that it's what's inside that matters. I want to deliver some wise, pithy adage she'll remember forever about beauty being skin deep, and that it's what's in your heart that counts. But honestly, her heart doesn't seem that beautiful either. She couldn't be bothered to take me out for something to eat, and I feel like I'm starving. Besides, what do I know about love? What do I even know about beauty or true hearts? I know nothing, because everything I've felt has been turned upside down.
You can do that, right? You can make me beautiful, right? I want blonde hair, and I want green eyes, and perfect cheekbones. And I want to be thin and tall, and have one of those faces that makes everyone look at you. She says in a voice full of a sick and fetid kind of longing.
Yes, I can do it. But do you really want to?
Of course. It's all I've ever wanted.
You find a granter and you wish for beauty? You're not going to wish for health or happiness? She tilts her head and gives me a sharp and loathing glance. Do you have any idea what it's like to look ordinary? I bet you don't, but I'll tell you what it's like. It's awful. It's like an awful trap, and I want out of it. We all have our traps, I suppose. This is hers. Okay, then. Let's talk payment, I say, because this is her wish, her life, her choice. I might as well let this girl know what's at stake, so she doesn't feel used as I was. Wishes come at a cost.
Okay, so what would it cost?
Your soul, your love, your heart, yourself, you name it.
You could give me one of your hands and we'd be even, I say. And she cringes, but I keep going. And this must be Granter magic too. This instant knowledge I have of how she'd need to pay.
Your firstborn child, and it'd be a deal.
Blake recoils.
You could subtract 20 years from your life and we'd be good then.
20 years? I tilt my head to the side, considering.
20 years.
Yep, that feels about right. 20 years off your life, I say. And I'm still not entirely sure where the words have come from, but I know them to be true.
That's how people pay for wishes?
I nod.
But what about... She begins, but can't finish the sentence.
I finish it for her.
It's called a Faustian bargain. It's called that for a reason. It's like a deal with the devil.
My voice is harsh and clipped, and if I could, I'd shake her by the shoulders and slap some sense into her. But she's calling the shots, not me.
She doesn't speak right away. She breathes out hard through tight lips, as if she's considering. I offer a faint wish to whoever is in charge that she'll see the light and walk away. But I believe in nothing anymore, so I don't even know who I'm wishing to.
Fine. 20 years from my life. I'll give you 20 years of my life in exchange for being beautiful.
If I were a jackass granter, I'd take the 20 years right now. I'd grant her wish literally, age her up to 35, and make her a beautiful 30-something woman in a 15-year-old's life. But I am a mastered granter. So I take out the notebook, write down her wish, and tell her, "The terms are satisfactory." Then I escort her to the nearest park, find a quiet corner, and ask her one more time to make her wish.
"I wish to be beautiful," Blake says.
"Your wish is my command," I say. And mist pours forth from my hands, swirling around her, transforming her limp hair into lushness, her plain face into model features, her short and squat body into a tall, statuesque one. She is gorgeous. She is stunning. She will turn heads, and no one she knows will recognize her. Her parents won't know she's her. Her classmates will no longer know Blake. Someday, maybe in 50 years, maybe in 10, someone will knock on her door, maybe me, maybe someone from the Union, and they will take her life 20 years before she would have to say goodbye to this world naturally. She rushes to the nearest parked car at the edge of the park and looks at her reflection.
"I am beautiful," she says.
Then she runs back to me and gives me a hug.
"Thank you."
"I'm still hungry," I say, but she's off in another direction, and I'm forgotten. Because she got what she thought she wanted, and I'm gone now too. I'm suddenly back in the library, like I was snapped through time and space. I'm weary, though I've had more sleep in the last month than I've had in ages. My feet are heavy, my eyes are so sleepy, but I still have form, I still have shape. So I make my way to the desk, sink down in the leather chair, and pull the registry closer to me so I can enter Blake Vader's name. The registry is open to the last entry made. The K's. The spot where my name was entered. I stave off sleep. I fend off hibernation as I run my thumb over the names, searching out mine. I need to know why the League's never made an example of me. Why they never strutted me around for stealing. The worst crime. The crime that echoes through your family forever. I find my entry. I slide my index finger across the ruled line. My name, Aria Kalandros. Back when I still had two names. Then the date, then the wish. I take a sharp breath. Bring a hand to my mouth. The marks are scratchy, as if someone wrote my name while fighting off an invisible hand trying to pen something else. As if the grantor recording this wish was resisting all the grantor magic, all the grantor orders and rules and regulations and stipulations and provisos and quid pro quos, with every ounce of strength inside him. Because it doesn't say natural-born fire. It says whole fire. Whole fire. It's not the full truth, but it's not a lie either. What it is, however, was enough of the truth for the Registry of Wishes, and enough of a lie for my family to be safe from my stealing. For Janna to have a chance to perform if she wants. For her kids. For the next generation to not be subjected to the League's rules of family banishment for all time. Because natural-born fire would tip off the Leagues that I had stolen. Whole fire merely suggests I topped myself off and wished for a little more. A small difference in wording, but a big difference in penalties, since no one knows I stole now. Taj recorded my wish, as he had to, but he recorded it in a way that satisfied the grantors and gave my family a chance. He protected them, and something inside me lightens and starts to hope again. One of his very last acts as a grantor was to try to keep me safe. Then, the choking feeling comes, and it hurts. I'm crushed into vapor. It goes like this for the next several weeks. I'm rousted from the dead of sleep by the greedy. I grant their basest desires for a price. Then I choke until I'm obliterated. Then it happens again. I grant a man millions of dollars in exchange for his right hand. Literally, that is what he offers to pay with. I give him a sharp and heavy knife, and he cuts it off himself, handing me the bloody stump one starless night in a dark corner of Central Park. I try to give it back to him, to tell him to take it to the nearest hospital emergency room and have the doctors sew it back on. But then the hand disappears. It's gone forever. He cries in pain, and I imagine he'll keep crying for weeks and months and years to come, even as he counts his money with his left hand. I grant an older woman a job. She's been looking for 3 years, and she offers me her happiness. I don't know where it goes when I take it. All I know is she'll no longer have it, and it'll be in the same place where that man's hand is, where Blake's shortened life is, in a bank full of horrid desires. Then I meet a boy who wishes for his sick father to be healthy. His dad has been ill for a year, and the boy offers himself as a trade. I remember the security guard with the sick sister who gave keys to Taj. I ask the boy if he'd instead be willing to give me his most valuable teddy bear, or baseball card, or even a book. He brings me his entire collection of invaluable first edition comic books the next day, and I grant his father health. Then I take the comic books back to my library. I wonder why I couldn't take the hand or the happiness with me. But maybe you can only take payments that aren't beyond measure. Maybe we get to keep only the things that are bartered in exchange for a better life for others, like when Taj kept the keys from the security guard. Maybe there are some noble wishes. Then again, Taj's parents didn't get to keep him when they traded him for peace. Maybe there are no good wishes. But if I could wish for one thing now, it would be for Taj to be enjoying his freedom. For the boy who protected my family to be living his life fully. I miss him. I miss him terribly. Chapter 32. The Only Payment. The alarm sounds again, and I rise, rub my eyes, and go through the same motions I went through with Blake and the one-handed man, and the job-hunting woman, and the boy with the sick dad. I brush my hair, wash my face, grab a new outfit, tisk-tisking the selection in the closet as I snag the least boring of all the boringest skirt-blouse-shoes ensembles. I open the door, walk through the tunnel, desperate for sunshine and air after this latest nap. I push up on the grate, wondering who I'll see, and there's a hand reaching for me, taking mine, and helping me the rest of the way up. I'm above ground, looking at my potential wisher, looking into eyes I know so well. Taj. I want to kick him. I want to wail on him with my fists. I want to yell at him, to ask him how he could have used me. I want to ask him why he tried to protect my family. I want to know if he missed me terribly, too. But it would be stupid to ask. He doesn't miss me. He needs something, just like I did. Instead, I fold my arms over my chest and stand against the side of the Flatiron building. I climbed out of a different grate tonight. I've started to learn the labyrinths.
You have no idea how long I've been looking for you, he says.
2 months. Every day for 2 months. I've been looking for you, and it's not as if I didn't know exactly where you'd be. But it took this long to find you, Arya.
You've been looking for me?
Yes, God, yes, all the time, every day. And I guess it's true. I had to be desperate enough. I had to be at my wit's end before you appeared.
But why? What could you possibly need from me? Isn't this the only thing you wanted? To be free?
I gesture at him, taking in his new look. He's wearing jeans and a button-down. Not quite the same as his sharp-dressed Granter look, but not that different either. Maybe he wasn't that different as a Granter and as a boy. But what do I know? Everything I thought I knew about him was a mask. There's a shopping bag at his feet.
Yes, and it's great. I'm going to college, and I've seen my mom again, and I'm wearing normal clothes. And it's the most wonderful thing in the world. Except...
I cut him off.
Then what do you want? What could you possibly have to wish for if you have everything you want? You used me. You tricked me into freeing you, and you admitted it at my house. That it was all a story to set you free.
He reaches for me, but I back up.
Arya, I've been looking for you. Not for me, but for you.
What's that supposed to mean? He dips a hand inside the shopping bag. He takes out my combat boots. The sight of them reminds me of all I don't have, and it's as if he just yanked a bandage off a still sore wound.
I brought these for you. I thought you might need them.
There's a glint in his eye. Why would I need them?
Arya, when I came to your house, the reason I lied to you and said all those awful things was because I didn't want the Union officials to have a clue. I couldn't let on how I felt about you. They already knew you tried to free me and that it didn't work, so they knew how you felt. I had to act like I'd used you, like I'd tricked you, that your feelings were all just a wisher's folly. I told you that it happened before, that wishers fell into infatuation. I had to make it seem like that's all that had happened with you. Because if I let on that I felt the same way, they'd have reassigned you, given you a new jurisdiction, and then I'd never have found you.
I hold up a hand in a stop sign. Wait, did you say felt the same way? He nods and grins, a sweet, sheepish grin. The smile of a boy, not the smile of a one-time Granter. The boy who kissed me. The boy who looked at stars with me. The boy who believed in the green light at the end of the dock. Maybe it wasn't an act?
Yes,
he says, and he sounds innocent and shy as he admits it.
Felt and feel, Arya. It was never just a tale told for freedom. The way I feel for you is a true story. It's real.
My heart is beating fast, and I'm scared and hopeful at the same time. It's so strange to feel this way.
Really?
Yes, really and truly. And more than like, Aria. I'm in love with you. And I want to make a wish.
My heart catches and plummets at the same time. Wishes and wants. It always comes down to that. I assume my best business-like pose as I reach into my pocket for the small notebook that's magically there, in every outfit, every uniform I now possess. I take it out, flip it open, and begin to take notes.
Let's get down to business. Your wish, sir? And what is it you want to offer in exchange?
He shakes his head, steps closer, and takes away my notebook.
The only wish that requires no payment, he says, as he drops my notebook to the sidewalk.
I watch it hit the ground before I realize my hands are shaking, my fingers are trembling. I can taste something. I can feel something. And it's so perilously close. I want to reach it, but I don't want to miss. The thing I've wanted most of all, my whole life over. The thing I've sought in different forms, in different shapes, trying on the wrong size, fumbling and stumbling and getting it wrong. But wanting it. Always wanting it. Freedom. I hope, and I wait, and I want. There is only one wish that costs nothing.
His lips quirk up, and he speaks again.
You freed me. And now, Aria, I wish you free.
I hold out my hands, and no sweet smoke rises from them, no mist to bring forth desires. Instead, I can feel the smoke coursing out of me, mingling with the real elements, with the air surrounding me, then being carried off on a current to become one with the atmosphere. I don't know where Granter magic goes when it's drained away, when you're freed of the bonds that come with incredible cosmic power and no free will. But it's no longer inside me. My body is mine. My will is mine. I am safe. Finally.
Your wish is my command, I say, as he takes my hands in his, pulls me close, and kisses me. He tastes like oranges, like he did that night we first kissed. Only this is better, because my heart is healed, all my wish-giving magic stripped away, and he's free too. I am me now, only me, and there's nothing better than this.
Except one little thing. I break the kiss. I hope you don't mind, but I'd really like to get out of these awful shoes.
I take the black patent leather shoes I vow to never wear again and leave them on the sidewalk. Someone will pick them up. Someone will wear them. Just not me. Instead, I pull on my lace-up boots, tying them the way I like. I look down at my footwear, at my worn and beaten-up boots that don't match my outfit. But they sure make this skirt look a heck of a lot better.
Ha, that's the girl I fell in love with. Boots and all.
Boots and all, I repeat. I take his hand. What would you say to going to New Jersey with me right now? There are some people I want to see.
I would say, let's catch the next bus.
Chapter 33, New Life.
Where's my math homework? I can't find it!
Jana shrieks and runs her hands through her hair, holding it hard. I place a hand on her shoulder to settle her.
Did you look in your backpack? I saw you put it in there last night when you finished.
Jana unzips her backpack and digs through the mountains of paper inside her binder, like a dog hunting for a bone.
Ah, there it is.
Dork, I say, rolling my eyes.
Now come on, my first class isn't for an hour, so I'm going to walk you to the bus stop.
I know where the bus stop is, You don't have to walk me. I want to, and I'm going to, I say. She narrows her eyes at me, shoots me a sharp stare. Just let me be the big sister, please. Fine, she says. Then she lowers her voice. I'm so glad you're back. And safe. Me too. I've been home for a month now, catching up on school. It's not easy, but I find the Spark Notes are helpful. I did read The Great Gatsby last week for English, though, and Tosh was right. It's so beautiful. Then I zip up my coat and tell Jana to put on a hat. It's freezing outside. It's ridiculous here, she says. It's so cold in December. I don't know how people survive like this. I love that we can talk about the weather, and the temperature truly is one of the few things we have to worry about. On the way to the bus stop, Jana chatters about a boy she likes. You should ask him out, I say. Her eyes widen. Really? Yeah, why not? She nods several times. Yeah, why not? And don't forget, be home by 3. You and Mom are taking me to the airport tonight. I'll be home. They let Xavi into the visiting room. He sits next to me on the couch. He shrugs at me, an admission that he's sorry we're back like this. Hey, I say softly. It's good to see you again.
You too.
How are you doing?
The same. Always the same.
I suspect he'll always be the same.
But what about you?
I'm good. Except for my brother being behind bars, life is extraordinarily good. It's also completely different from what I imagined. I always thought I'd have to save everyone. Jana, my mom, myself. In the end, I couldn't save myself. I had to be saved. But then, knowing who to trust and who to love, Taj, was what saved me in the end. He saved me because I finally let someone know me.
How's school?
I'm finishing my senior year of high school, I tell him. I started late. I missed the first 2 months of the school year with that whole Granter thing, but I'm making up for lost time.
And Jana?
Oh, you know. She still misses Florida, but she's getting used to Jersey. He shakes his head and laughs.
Can't believe you live in New Jersey, of all places.
I know, right? But Mom likes the change. We have a small apartment, and she had enough money to buy it from the sale of the house.
And you?
Me?
Yeah, you dork. You.
How am I? I don't perform anymore, and I don't miss it at all. And I haven't gone dark inside, like Xavi said would happen. Turns out we are different in some ways. Some people go crazy when they don't use their fire. Some people grow saner. No one's coming to get me. No one's coming to lock me up. I may have stolen fire, but I don't use it anymore. I'd like to say it's my penance, my punishment for the crime. But truth be told, I actually like not making fire. I'm happy. I'm going to apply to college. Maybe study English or something. I don't know. Or maybe I'll just be a barista. I don't really know what I want to do with my life. But I don't have to, because my life is finally mine. Taj waits for me outside, reading a book. He's sitting on a bench just beyond the chain-link fence that keeps the prisoners inside. I watch him as he flips back a few pages, scans the words for whatever he's looking for, then returns to where he left off. He likes reading even more now that he can take his time with books, now that he has time. He doesn't have to race against a clock. I sit down next to him. Good book? I ask.
Great book.
I'm going to need to get you a How to Take Care of Florida Wildlife one next.
Oh, yeah?
I nod. Yep. I need to go check on the gator. I promised I'd look out for him. A deal is a deal, after all. This has been an Audible Studios production of The Fire Artist. Written by Daisy Whitney. Narrated by Cassandra Morris. Producer, Mike Charzik. Copyright 2014 by Daisy Whitney. Production copyright 2014 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.